In Iran, tens of thousands gathered this morning at Tehran University to help Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei speak.
The enemies of Islam have always wanted to agitate Muslims' hearts and give them anxiety. In the course of
it's a week to the day
Islam,
since the first results of a disputed election that has riven this nation. You're hearing a BBC Islam translation of the words of the Ayatollah, but up ahead, an analysis of those words, all here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, June 19th. I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry is away. We're continuing our live coverage of events in Iran, plus a look at some more domestic news, including yesterday's Supreme Court decision on DNA testing and an arts quiz. Let's see if you pass. First, we're going to turn to Femi Okeh and some headlines.
Hello there, Catherine. Good morning, everybody. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is upholding the country's disputed election results. He says the 11 million votes that incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad won by is too big to be falsified. Opposition supporters say the election was rigged and have been protesting since last week. Home here in the United States, Defense Secretary Robert Gates told CBS that authoritarian regimes face a new challenge in social networking sites.
Their efforts, while successful in some respects, they just can't draw the net tight enough to stop everything. And you know, if you can't text, then you Twitter.
Gates says the sites keep authoritarian governments from having a monopoly on information and make it easier for citizens to communicate freely. Catherine.
Financier Alan Stanford will appear in federal court today in Richmond, Virginia, on charges of fraud. He surrendered to FBI officials yesterday. Stanford is accused of conducting an $8 billion Ponzi scheme. A major war spending bill has passed Congress and now goes to the president. It funds the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan until the end of the fiscal year. The $106 billion measure included a couple of other provisions, such as $1 billion for a Cash for Clunkers program. Meanwhile, in Pakistan, the government says the army's military operation against Taliban militants in the Swat Valley is almost over and that people will be able to return to their homes there tomorrow. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow rose 0.7% to close at 85.86. The S&P rose 0.8% to close at 9.18. It's the start of Father's Day weekend, and we are talking about our dads. Give us your make room for daddy moment. What's your best memory? Your favorite story? What does your dad mean to you?
I'm Charlotte, and I'm age 6, and this is what I like to do with my dad. I like to go watch movies with him. I like to play with him and a lot of fun stuff.
Wow. So, are you going to call in, Femi? I want to hear your favorite
story. Charlotte's dad?
No.
I am definitely calling Charlotte's dad. Charlotte's dad, please will you adopt me? Charlotte sounds adorable, and I want to be your daughter as well.
Well, you're pretty adorable, Femme. Meanwhile, your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lamper, in for John Hockenberry. What you're hearing right now, the cheers of tens of thousands that gathered earlier this morning in Iran at Tehran University to hear the words of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
Having trust in the Islamic Republic state was displayed and revealed during the elections. I will let you know later on. The enemies of the Iranian nation want to break this trust in the state.
Those are the words of Ayatollah Khamenei, and that's one translation. For some analysis, we're turning to Jonathan Marcus from our partners, the BBC in London. Turned to him earlier this morning.
It was a lengthy speech, about an hour and three quarters or so. I suppose typical for the sort of person he is and the situation in which he was speaking. But a very tough message, fundamentally. He called for an end to the street demonstrations. He said that the opposition would be blamed for any violence that occurred now. He said that the street protests will not pressure the establishment, the authorities, to accept what he called the illegal demands made by the candidates. So a tough speech. Really a call to draw a line under all of this now.
Well, and talk about what was at stake for him. There had been some thought that maybe he would try to accommodate the concerns of those who were out on the streets, but obviously that's not so.
Well, I think the difficulty for the Iranian system, if you like, is that they haven't really left themselves any institutional means of climbing down. After all, it was the Supreme Leader himself who very quickly came out and endorsed the election results and accepted that President Ahmadinejad had been re-elected. And once he had done that, it's very hard to see any climbing down. Obviously, there has been an acceptance of a partial recount of the ballots in certain places. I understand that the initial, certainly in one province where that has already been done, it's simply confirmed the results as they were before. I don't think anybody expects that partial recount is going to alter the situation. I think many of the critics of the regime had been wanting to see a full rerun of the presidential contest. That clearly isn't going to happen now. So it was a tough speech. There was an element of conciliation, though. He went out of his way to stress that all of the candidates were not, you know, none of the candidates were against the Islamic State. This was a dispute within the state, as it were, not by opponents from outside. He was quite positive on his longtime rival, Hashemi Rafsanjani, a man who's widely been accused of corruption, a chief rival of the Supreme Leader. He went out of his way to explicitly say this was wrong to accuse Mr. Rafsanjani of corruption and so on. But the fundamental message about the disorder, about the continuing opposition to the election results was clear.
So what position does this leave the protesters in? If the Ayatollah was in one tough spot and couldn't climb down, where are they?
Well, that really now is the fundamental question. What are we going to see in the ensuing days? Are we going to see continuing demonstrations? What are clear key leaders like Mr. Mousavi going to say, who had been on occasions calling for people to come out onto the streets and so on? One has a strong sense that behind the scenes, all of these people have been told by the Supreme Leader that this has got to stop now. It's going to be interesting to see whether if they apply the brakes, it applies a brake to the largely spontaneous public pressure that there has been. And of course, in the speech as well, there was an awful lot of condemnation of the world outside. He singled out Britain in particular for condemnation. He called on the Iranians to see the hand of the enemy in all of what was going on. The most evil, he said, was the British government. And he made a very strange comparison. He talked about American Zionist money creating political change in Georgia. I'm not sure exactly what he was referring to there, but he very strongly, in effect, said, well, Iran is no Georgia. Who do they think they're dealing with, these people? We are a serious country and we can express the will of our people in our own way. So not much concession there.
What about the meeting that was going to be held between the three candidates, the minority candidates, if you will, that they were going to go over election results? Is that meeting still on?
I don't have any ability to say what is actually going on behind the scenes. I think this is one of the great problems. I mean, you see, obviously, the events on the streets. You have this extraordinary avalanche through the electronic media, the Twitters and so on and so forth, of all kinds of opinion coming out of the country. But, of course, what is entirely unclear, what is entirely shrouded in a certain amount of mystery, really, is what is actually going on inside the ruling circles, the clerical circles. But I think from the message that the Supreme Leader gave in his speech today, a very uncompromising message, as I say, a call for a line to be drawn and for all of this to end now, I think that gives us a strong sense of what the tenor of the debate may well be inside the ruling circles of the regime.
Jonathan Marcus, I want to thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Jonathan Marcus, with our partners, the BBC in London. We're now going to turn to Erik Bjornlund. He is a president and founder of Democracy International. It's a consulting firm that helps governments create free and fair elections. He's monitored elections throughout the world, Africa, Asia, the Middle East. Now, the Ayatollah Khamenei was just saying that these elections were not rigged, that they were free and fair. And yet there are, of course, many people who suspect otherwise. And we're going to turn to Erik for a little insight. Erik, we know that there were no international monitors observing this election. But even from a distance, what can we tell?
Well, ultimately, we can't tell the final answer about whether the votes were counted accurately. We can tell that the election didn't meet certain international standards. Their elections are more than just what happens on election day, and we do know that there were limitations on the extent of the democracy in Iran. We know that the legal and institutional framework doesn't allow for everyone to have access to the ballots, and the Guardian Council can restrict who the candidates are. We know that there were limits on media access before the election and misuse of government resources by the incumbent. But we ultimately really won't know and cannot know whether the ballots were counted accurately.
You've been monitoring elections for 25 years. When you first started looking for details and clues about this election, what was the first thing that grabbed your attention?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of speculation that is not well-founded. We can't rely on polls done several weeks before the election that may have suggested a certain turnout that is a certain result that's not a good basis for knowing what happened on election day. I think that one thing that does raise suspicions is the very quick announcement of the election results. This was an election in which an estimated 39 million people voted mostly or entirely by hand ballots counted locally by hand, and yet the election results were announced very shortly after the close of polls. In other elections that we've monitored where ballots have been cast locally by hand, the time to count them is much, much longer than that. For one thing, it takes more than an hour typically to count the ballots at a local place. But more than that, it takes a very long time to transmit those results to a central place and have them be aggregated. So the quick announcement of the results, I think, is the most indicative suggestion that the ballots were not counted carefully and accurately.
If you look at the analysis that is coming out of Iran, there are some, I would say, cautioning words coming out now that there were indeed a sizable number of people who did vote for President Ahmadinejad. So what caution would you offer to us about simply dismissing his support in that country?
Well, I think one thing that this election shows is that Iran is a lot more competitive, has a lot more competitive politics than most Americans previously realized. And the extent of the competition, the type of competition, the turnout is remarkable. I think it's clear that President Ahmadinejad had a lot of support and won a lot of votes. It's also, I think, clear from outside that the challenger Mousavi gained a lot of votes. I think that we do have to be very careful about jumping to conclusions about who won the most votes. I think we don't have enough information. I think this is also an example of why it's unfortunate that Iran is not part of the international consensus on accepting international observers.
Okay.
If, in fact, Ahmadinejad won the most votes, there was no international presence that's able to validate that fact.
Okay.
So I think, unfortunately, we really don't know what the election results were.
Oh, Erik, I want to thank you for joining us. That's Erik Bjornlund. He's president and founder of Democracy International. Want to remind you, of course, we're still taking your Dad's Day stories, 8778 MyTake, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry today. We'll be talking about DNA testing for convicts in just a moment, but we're going to spend just a few minutes on a lighter note here talking about dads. It's the start of Father's Day weekend. So we're starting it off with an ode to dad. Make room for daddy. What's the best thing about your father? Let us know.
One of my favorite memories with my father involves him teaching me how to drive a stick shift. We would go to the empty parking lot at the mall on Sunday, and it was a Datsun B210, which had a very crude shift mechanism, and I was not good at the clutch, and we would just bounce around that parking lot like a bucking bronco. And after maybe an hour, we would finish up, switch sides, and he'd get back in the driver's seat, and we'd be laughing our heads off and saying, "We're alive, we're alive."
Ah, yes. The father-daughter driving lesson. I know that one. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, do convicts have a constitutional right to DNA testing? In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday against a convicted rapist from Alaska who was seeking the testing. We're going to go now to Nina Morrison, who's here in our studio. She's a staff attorney at the Innocence Project. She was involved with this case. We want to also mention that there are 4 states that don't allow DNA challenges, and we're going to be talking about it. Hey, good morning, Nina.
Good morning, Catherine.
Given that 46 states do allow DNA testing for those already convicted, what are the ramifications of this decision?
Well, it was a very disappointing decision, but we think as a practical matter, the impact will probably be very limited. That's partly because there are so many states that have acted to put DNA testing laws on the books, and partly because so many prosecutors actually consent to DNA testing because they recognize that it can conclusively prove innocence and in some cases confirm guilt, and there's no good reason not to do a DNA test. Alaska's really one of the real outliers in this area, and for those in Alaska and other states, it will have a difficult impact.
Let's talk a little bit about this particular case. It involved a William Osborne. He was convicted for rape and assault, I believe, in 1993. Talk a little bit more about the details of this case, the circumstances.
Sure. Mr. Osborne was convicted of a rape, and what makes this case important for DNA testing purposes is that there was evidence collected from the rape that everyone agrees could conclusively prove if he did or didn't commit the crime. He put a misidentification defense on at trial. He said he wasn't there and didn't do it. And what we found in so many cases is no matter how guilty somebody looks, there's no substitute for doing a DNA test which can prove it either way. And we were hoping the Supreme Court would agree that the Constitution at a minimum requires a state can't drag this out in litigation for years and they just have to do a DNA test. And unfortunately, at least in Mr. Osborne's case, we didn't get that ruling yesterday.
You know, given some of the details of this case, in fact, even the way that Mr. Osborne, he didn't come out and say, "I'm innocent and I can prove it." It was a more finely tuned point. If you look at the coverage of this, he said, "Look, this will definitively prove whether I am guilty or innocent." And I believe Justice Scalia even made a point of this and said, "Look, this person wasn't saying he was innocent. He was just saying you could really tell."
Yeah, Justice Scalia brought that up in oral argument, and the state made a big deal of that point. But, you know, we've seen in dozens of cases that people who give even full confessions to crimes might be innocent. And there's no reason to speculate about did he really mean he's innocent, or when he said he was innocent 10 years ago, was that what he meant, when you can just do a DNA test. And we're fortunate that most prosecutors and most judges understand that, and most states recognize it. But that's not to minimize the difficulty that a number of people, including Mr. Osborne, have trying to get DNA testing done. You know, I've had clients who waited 10 years for a DNA test that freed them. They lost a decade with their families. Some of them had serious illnesses and could have died in prison. You know, prison's also a very dangerous place. You could get killed at any time. And these delays really are very harmful.
There are some criticisms that maybe this wasn't the best case to take to the Supreme Court for this particular point.
Yeah, you know, we represent our clients. We don't choose our cases. We actually had won in the lower courts, and so it was the state that wanted to take this up and make it a national issue. But I think the Supreme Court has left the door open for future challenges in federal court. We hope those won't be necessary and that this will give us some momentum. You know, if you go to our website, you can read a lot more about some of the difficulties in different states that people have getting DNA testing at innocenceproject.org. But, you know, we're engaged in this battle in all 50 states, and we're hopeful it'll continue.
And also to go back to this particular case for a moment, there was advanced DNA testing available at the time he was in his original trial. Why wasn't use made of it then?
There was an early form of DNA testing that actually was limited, and the state's own expert said he thought that the evidence was too small in quantity and too degraded to do that kind of testing. So nobody tried it at the time. William Osborne said he asked his own lawyer to do it. He even wrote to an outside expert for assistance. She was inexperienced in DNA matters, and she didn't think it was a good idea to do the test. So one thing we said to the Supreme Court is, if someone might be innocent, why should they be stuck with a lawyer's decision, you know, public defender's decision not to do a DNA test, when we can find out what the test would have shown? You know, it's one of those side issues that's very frustrating to keep facing when there's a simple test that could just get to the truth.
There are just four states that don't allow this. Why not?
Yeah, there's actually three. Alabama just passed a law a few weeks ago, but a very, very limited one that only allows it in capital cases and under extraordinary circumstances. You know, it's hard to know why the other three states haven't come into line, and also why some states that have very strict limitations don't improve those laws. You know, convicted prisoners are not the most powerful interest group in the country. I think it's a sign of what a broad consensus there is on the issue that we've managed in less than a decade to get so many laws passed, but hopefully this will give us a little momentum.
And quickly, also talk about the fact that it isn't just defense attorneys who want DNA testing.
That's right. We've had, in over half the cases where people have been exonerated, we've gotten consent from prosecutors to do the test and haven't needed to go to court. You know, Mr. Osborne's case is different. We've been fighting for a decade, and unfortunately, after yesterday's decision, and we'll have to keep fighting a little longer.
All right. Nina Morrison, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nina Morrison is a staff attorney at the Innocence Project, a nonprofit that works to free wrongly convicted prisoners. Want to remind you, of course, that along with the news, we're also collecting your stories. Make room for Daddy. Give us your favorite story about your father at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or go to the takeaway. MyTakeAtTheTakeaway.org. We have Femi Yoke in now with some headlines.
Thanks, Catherine. 28 minutes past the hour. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says that the Iranians should not go out on the streets to take part in protests over the contested presidential elections. He says that they will be held responsible for any chaos that happens. Defense Secretary Robert Gates was talking on CBS this morning. He was saying how media like Twitter is a huge advantage to the opposition in Iran right now because not everybody understands how the technology works, and it's tough to stop the flow of information.
My guess is in some of these countries that that the leadership is kind of like me. They don't have a clue what it's about.
You need to Twitter Gates. Gates says the sites keep authoritarian governments from having a monopoly on the information. He obviously hasn't been to the Obama administration social networking course quite yet.
The military tweets, Department of Defense tweets.
Need to get up to speed just a little bit. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning, Catherine.
All right. Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at RockFound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry, who's away. We'll be hearing the stories from Iranians on the ground in just a moment, but right now we're asking you for your stories about your dad. It's the start of Father's Day weekend, and we'd like to know what your most vivid memory is, your favorite story. Did he teach you how to drive? Did he teach you how to use a saw? Come on, tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Maybe he taught you how to cook. MyTake@thetakeaway.org. But for now, we're going to go back to the news and Iran, where Ayatollah Khamenei gave a speech earlier this morning at Tehran University.
The 12th June elections was a great demonstration of a sense of responsibility by our nation to determine the fate of their country.
You're listening to a BBC translation of the speech from earlier this morning. Ayatollah Khamenei speaking to tens of thousands gathered at Tehran University. There are a lot of translations. There's a lot of analyses of what happened this morning. And for one of them, we're going to go to our friend Professor Hamid Dabashi. He is a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. And he's also the author of Iran, A People Interrupted, and Islamic Liberation Theology, Resisting the Empire. We should also note that he is a voter. He voted for Mousavi, Mir Hussein Mousavi, one of the opposition candidates. Professor, we've already heard from the BBC and their take on the speech. The Supreme Leader saying that the elections were fair, urging protesters to stay off the street. What is your takeaway from this 1 hour and 45-minute speech?
The speech begins as I listen to the entirety of this thing. It begins as a very paternalistic kind grandfather talking to his grandchildren, kind of a tone, and gradually the crescendo goes up and becomes admonitory, be careful, you're being manipulated, those who are in the streets and such, and ultimately ends by being very threatening. The way that he usually becomes threatening is by attacking U.S. and United Kingdom in particular, aiming at BBC and CNN and so forth. He named the United States in particular, President Obama in particular, mentioned Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, etc. But the point is that all of these are standard operations, nothing new. He's in complete denial. He simply doesn't seem to be seeing these millions of people are putting into the streets and blaming it on foreign influences and such. But ultimately, he does concede that there are problems with the perception of people of the election. He reiterates support for Ahmadinejad, and he says if you have concern about the election, simply follow the legal channels. And then he raised his voice and said, I will not concede to people in the streets. I will only follow legal channels.
In fact, let's go and listen to some sound from Ayatollah Khamenei.
It was a great display of a cooperative soul of our nation in ruling their country.
All right. He says it's a great display. The great display, of course, was also taking place in the streets with the hundreds of thousands of protesters. What's going to happen now? What are the stakes for them?
You put your finger on it. Presidential election that we have in Iran, Khamenei uses it as an indication of, look how popular and widespread is our support among the population. In other words, they are so conscious of the fact that they're illegitimate operation, that people don't approve of them, that they need to be constantly reminded. The fact of the matter is, the last presidential election, about 20 million of eligible voters did not go to vote. This time around, yes, indeed, 85% of the eligible voters participated, but this was not an endorsement of the entirety of the Islamic Republic, nor, we have to be cautious, was it a revolution against the Islamic Republic. It was a civil expression of dissatisfaction with the status quo and opting for the best possible candidate that the Islamic Republic had allowed to run. And as a result, we have a direct confrontation now, not only between masses of dissatisfied segments of the population with the Islamic Republic and those who are, but also from within the regime, namely Mousavi, Karoubi, and former President Khatami, who are standing on one corner, and Khamenei and Ahmadinejad, who are standing in another. Namely, the internal contradiction within the Islamic Republic, which is already in the two words Islamic Republic, this does, is coming to surface. This does not mean that Islam in its entirety is incompatible with democracy. What it means is the rule of the clergy, the juridical thinking which is governing the Islamic Republic is not compatible with democracy.
There was going to be a meeting of the three losing presidential candidates with the Guardian Council.
It has taken place.
And what happened there?
They have concluded that there are, according to their estimation, the report that comes from the Guardian Council, 646 cases of irregularities have been reported to the Guardian Council, and the Guardian Council has agreed to consider them and examine them and so forth. From the oppositional camp, we have multiple voices coming out, Karoubi, Mousavi, and the former president, Khatami. They are asking for anything ranging from specific ballot boxes to be reconsidered to the annulment of the election altogether. So we don't know which one of these three positions, which are rather radically different, is going to be taken into consideration.
All right.
But also, just let me conclude, from the Guardian Council side, they have also on occasion agreed that it is not entirely impossible for the whole election to be annulled. So it's a power game now between the Guardian Council and the oppositional forces. We have to wait and see how it unfolds.
And it's a power game we're going to keep track of. Professor, thanks so much for your time. Professor Hamid Dabashi, Professor of Iranian Studies at Columbia University. Now we go to our favorite professor of the headlines, Femi Yoke from the newsroom.
Excellent. Thank you very much for the accolade. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. Texas billionaire Alan Stanford is scheduled to appear in federal court today on fraud charges. Stanford surrendered to the FBI last night. He's accused of running a multi-billion dollar pyramid scheme through a Caribbean bank. Stanford maintains his innocence. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is shoring up missile defense systems around Hawaii as a precaution against a possible missile attack by North Korea. Hawaii is the site of the main U.S. military base in the Pacific, but the base is about 500 miles out of the reach for North Korea's missile. On Capitol Hill, the Senate unanimously passed a resolution yesterday apologizing for slavery. But the Senate version explicitly says that the resolution can't be used to support reparations. The Senate vote paves the way for a joint congressional resolution. Last year, the House passed a similar apology. Taking a look at international news now, in Spain, a senior police officer has been killed in a car bomb attack in the Basque region. The Basque regional government blamed the bomb on the militant separatist group ETA, which ended a ceasefire with the government 2 years ago. That's some of the big stories making news this morning, Catherine.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry is away today. Okay, the forgotten sleeper at this year's U.S. Open at Bethpage? That would be Mother Nature. The longest course in Open history is even more treacherous now. There was a downpour yesterday. Half the field, you couldn't even step out on it. Of course, the rain is just one of the storylines at the Open. We have Tiger Woods defending his Open title. We also have Phil Mickelson. He's hitting the links as his wife is facing breast cancer surgery. We speak with ESPN.com golf writer Bob Herrig. Hey, Bob.
Good morning.
I hate to spend time talking about the weather, but it's the weather. What's going on today?
Yeah, that's the big story, unfortunately, because things were thrown off course yesterday. With so much rain, I mean, they only played for 3 hours, and Now there's a lot of catching up to do, and with more rain in the forecast, it's going to make for a long weekend for these guys.
I was just going to say, how long can this really go on? They have squeegees at every hole. They have huge, giant, I think they call them water hogs, that are trying to suck up all the water from the grounds. Has there ever been like a 3-week open?
No, but you know, there have been opens that have gone to Monday and Tuesday, if that's what they have to do, that's what they'll do. You know, they will. The U.S. Open is going to be 72 holes, and whatever it takes to get 72 holes completed. So,
and we should point out, this is on the longest course in Open history. How does that also change this story?
Well, it makes it play even longer when it's this wet, because they don't get any roll. The ball isn't going to hit the ground and roll another 20 or 30 or 40 yards like we saw last year in California when the U.S. Open was at Torrey Pines. So that, that makes that long golf course play even longer.
You know, even if all you know about golf is how to make a divot, there's some pretty compelling stories here. What should people be looking out for, besides Mr. Tiger Woods?
Well, as you mentioned, Phil Mickelson is playing. Despite learning recently that his wife has breast cancer, it's been a big story in golf. He's probably going to take some time off after this week to be with her as her treatment begins. And he's a very, very popular player in New York. He's come close a few times in the Opens here.
Wait, hang on a minute. He's a California guy. Doesn't he even have his own jet? How does this get, you know, this is a city with Mets fans, for goodness sake.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery. You're right. Why would Phil be so popular here? But he is. They really took to him. Whereas they might have gotten on a few other guys. But, the U.S. Open is filled with dreamers, too, guys who qualify, who nobody's ever heard of. And then there's a bunch of other name players as well, the guys that you hear of every week. But, who knows who's going to emerge with all that's going on out there.
All right. And just to wrap up, give me one dark horse that I should be rooting for this weekend.
Well, I call him a dark horse probably because people don't really know who he is. But Paul Casey, he's really not. He's ranked third in the world behind Tiger and Phil. But he's from England, and people don't know a lot about him here, even though he lives in Arizona.
Okay, an Arizona Englishman. I like the sounds of that. Thanks a lot for joining us, Bob.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Bob Herrick, golf writer for ESPN.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanford, in for John Hockenberry, who's away. It's the start of Father's Day weekend, so let's start it off with an ode to dear old Dad. Come on, tell us, what is one of the best things about your dad? What memory or moment best sums him up for you?
My name is Steve. I'm calling from Long Island, New York. My earliest memory of my father was a day that we spent the entire day opening our pool. It took hours and hours to open the pool. My dad's a real hard-working guy. We never took breaks. And I remember that afternoon falling asleep on the living room floor with my dad, and my mom came home and thought something horrible had happened. I'm not the kind of guy to take a nap in the middle of the day, and I'm not the kind of guy to take a nap in the middle of the day, but the two of us were laying there on the floor in the afternoon in the sun.
Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or my take at thetakeaway.org. Now to a different kind of story, the latest from the newsroom with Femi Oke.
Thanks, Catherine. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is denying accusations that the country's presidential election was rigged.
A free competition, serious competition, and transparent competition among various candidates. Everyone was a witness to this fact.
The Ayatollah says that the incumbent president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was the definitive victor. And these were his first public remarks since protests began over the election. Google says that it's speeding up its development of its tools to translate the Persian language, it's also known as Farsi, into English. They're doing it in response to the huge increase in interest in Iran. And meanwhile, Facebook is also providing a Persian translation of its site. The Supreme Court has ruled that prisoners do not have a constitutional right to DNA testing after their conviction. Chief Justice John G. Roberts wrote for the majority, saying it's up to the states and Congress to decide who has a right to the tests. And staying with the DNA theme, there's news of John Barnes, a man who was convinced he'd been abducted more than 50 years ago.
My gut tells me that I am related to the Dammons, but I'm not going to say I am until the FBI tells me I am.
Apparently, John Barnes's gut was wrong. DNA testing has proved that Barnes, who claimed to be the kidnapped son of an Iowa farmer, actually wasn't. John Barnes had said he was the toddler who disappeared on Halloween more than 50 years ago, but his DNA doesn't match those of his would-be siblings. And you may be wondering what's happening to his family in the meantime. The family who raised Barnes in Michigan angrily rejected the idea that he wasn't their son, but he has been quoted as saying that they don't look like me, they don't act like me, I couldn't possibly be their son. Although I do know how he feels sometimes. That's a look at your news for now, Catherine.
Oh, you want to imagine Thanksgiving? Okay, class. Pop quiz. Can you identify the instrumental ensemble playing here? What kind is it? Is it a brass quintet, a symphony orchestra, a concert band, a bluegrass band? If you were in the eighth grade last year, you very well might have been asked that question by the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And the answers they got were disappointing. Results for a similar test in 1997 were low, and those results last year, even lower. Joining us right now is Richard Kessler, Executive Director of the Center for Arts Education. Also joining us from Plainfield, New Jersey, is Emily Downs, an art teacher for kindergarten through fourth graders. Okay, you two, pop quiz. We're going to start with you, Richard Kessler. What's the right answer?
The right answer is symphony orchestra.
You knew. You peaked.
No, I knew I did. Okay. I knew in advance.
You did, Emily?
Symphony orchestra, I totally agree.
Well, you agree, but did you know beforehand as well?
Yes, I did. I'm proud to say that.
Okay. Richard, I'm going to go back to you for a minute. So you passed the pop quiz, but let's talk about the test results. What is your reaction?
My reaction is that I'm not surprised. The test results essentially were telling us about student achievement in the arts at the eighth grade. And we're not surprised that 71% of the students were able to determine, in fact, that that was a symphony orchestra. We were not surprised that 20% of the students were able to tell you that P in music notation means piano, which means soft. And one of the reasons why we're not surprised is while some of the students who took these tests at the eighth grade may have had music instruction and art instruction for many years preceding that, you know, there were also students who may have had no music instruction or almost none before they took the test in the eighth grade. And that tells you a little bit about what the terrain is. Some kids are getting music and art and dance and theater, and some kids are getting nothing.
Hey, Emily, I know that the kids that you teach are obviously younger than eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think any of them could have answered the question that we played?
I do. I think that our students are in a middle-class suburban school. They are receiving instrumental education as well as vocal music instruction roughly once a week, and I do believe that it certainly at least the third and fourth grade students would have probably attained the same scores as the eighth graders answering the question.
Hey, I have to ask both of you, how many adults do you think would have gotten that right? Richard?
I think most adults would have gotten that right. I do.
Emily?
Yeah, I would say the same, maybe three quarters.
I was just going to say, you know, you guys have more faith in people than I do. I mean, let's talk about some of the questions that were asked on this test. Like, for instance, for music, identify the pitch contour of melody in a recording. I'm not even sure I understand what that means. Richard?
Well, it's, you know, looking at it on paper, it's abstract. I mean, what you have to realize is we're asking for kids who are studying music. Look, if you're not studying music, the question makes no sense at all. But if you've been involved in music instruction since kindergarten, as kids should, and in New York State, that's in fact the law, it does make sense. It's not just an abstract question, but what are they learning over the course of 7 or 8 years?
Let's go to another question that isn't abstract, that is, in fact, musical. That, of course, is Rhapsody in Blue, George Gershwin. But here's the question for you all out there. Was what we're listening to right now, is this a flute, an oboe, a saxophone, or a clarinet? All right, Emily, pop quiz. Give me the answer.
It is a clarinet.
All right. Okay, you passed. But let's, you know, talk about the fact that, you know, this is a classic piece of music. It was written to be classical when Gershwin composed it. He wanted to step away from the popular music he was doing. But how much of these test results are perhaps the result of kids being steeped in their own popular culture?
That's a good question. I think that, and it's an important part of their education to expose them to all culture, including their own. Certainly that's going to be the best way to reach and relate to your students, is to understand their culture and, you know, relate to them on that level as much as possible. But it's also important for them to get the canon of music history and art history as part of their early education. We have this whole element of cultural and social intelligence that relies on the arts, and it's not information that you just pick up innately. It's something that has to be taught. It's a system of symbols. You know, recognizing a Warhol painting or Beethoven's Fifth is just part of being a well-rounded person. You know, we need arts education to be part of our children's everyday experience so that they can be those well-rounded people.
And in fact, we also know that arts education helps raise scores in, for instance, math and science. Richard?
Yes.
It does all sorts of things. It's not just an issue of test scores. It's an issue of attendance. We know that kids come to school early on their own time, before school starts, for the arts. They stay late. We know that parents, when they come to schools, they come for arts performances. If you walk into a school that has the arts, you're going to see art. You're going to hear art. You're going to see a school alive with color. You walk into a school that has no arts, you see a school that's gray, a school that's sterile.
All right. And just to wrap up, when you have test results like this, do you find that people pay more attention to the whole issue of arts education?
I think it's not so much the issue of the test scores themselves. I think that more attention has been paid to this issue right now because it is NAEP, what's called the nation's report card. It's gotten a tremendous amount of press, and it tells us a little bit about the kinds of attention that needs to be paid.
Hey, I want to thank you both for joining us. Richard Kessler, Executive Director of the Center for Arts Education. Emily Downs, a K-4 art teacher in New Jersey. You passed. Good job, everybody. All day today, we've been talking about dads. It's the start of Father's Day weekend. Tell us your favorite memory about your dad, what you're going to celebrate on Father's Day Sunday. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Now, here is your takeaway.
One has a strong sense that behind the scenes, all of these people have been told by the Supreme Leader that this has got to stop now. It's going to be interesting to see whether if they apply the brakes.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Marcus. We're going to continue, of course, our coverage of events earlier this morning in Iran. Meanwhile, give us that dad story. I know, he must have done something. He taught you to drive. Maybe he gave you your allowance. Maybe he taught you how to cook. Maybe he taught you how to be a dad yourself. Go ahead, call us, 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Catherine Lanfer, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The great leader speaks to the world.
The 12th June elections was a great demonstration of a sense of responsibility by our nation to determine the fate of their country. It was a great display of a cooperative soul of our nation in ruling their country.
That's a BBC translation of the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei speaking to thousands of people earlier this morning in Iran. He says that protests on the streets are a challenge to democracy. Protesters say they're just challenging election results. A battle for the soul of a nation? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, June 19th. I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry's away. Coming up this hour, we continue our coverage of Iran and also whether the media is making too much of what's been called a Twittergasm. We also get an inside view of Persian TV, and we look at Congress's back and forth over health care. Right now, though, we're going to go to Femi Okey and some headlines.
Good morning, Catherine. Good morning, all. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is upholding the country's disputed election results. He says that the incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's margin of victory is too large to be doubted.
But how can 11 million votes be replaced or changed?
President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad watched the Ayatollah speak those words from the front row. State television did not show whether the main opposition candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi, was in attendance. Here in the U.S., Defense Secretary Robert Gates is increasing missile defense systems around Hawaii. It's a precaution against a possible missile attack by North Korea.
Without telegraphing what we will do, I would just say we are in a good position should it become necessary to protect American territory.
Hawaii is the site of the main U.S. military base in the Pacific. The added security measures are due to concern that North Korea might try to retaliate for stiffer U.N. sanctions. Hawaii is around about 500 miles out of reach of North Korea's missiles. Catherine.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved a spending bill that would fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for the next few months. The vote was 91-5. The $106 billion measure now goes to President Obama for his signature. The Senate has also unanimously passed a resolution apologizing for slavery. Lawmakers, however, explicitly said the resolution cannot be used to support reparations. That vote paves the way for a joint congressional resolution. Last year, the House passed a similar apology. It's going to be another wet day on the golf course for U.S. Open players. Downpours yesterday shut down play at the Bethpage Black Course on New York's Long Island. And on Wall Street yesterday, the Dow rose 0.7% to close at 85.86. The S&P rose 0.8% to close at 918. It is the start of Father's Day weekend. We're starting off with an ode to Dad. Make room for Daddy and tell us your favorite story about your pop. 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to My Take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
We've been talking about health care all week. I'm Catherine Lanford, in for John Hockenberry, who's away. Now, with all the debate on health care reform, you'd think that one thing wouldn't prompt much argument. Prevention. I mean, you treat people before they get sick. You're going to save money in the long term, right? Not so fast. We're going to look at this healthy debate over prevention with our own Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. All right, Todd, let's start by talking about what Congress is trying to do with prevention.
Yeah, hi, Catherine. Good morning. Well, you know, with all of the contentious debate going on in Congress right now on health reform, Republicans, Democrats actually agree on one major thing, and you mentioned it's prevention. They want to do more to encourage prevention, wellness programs, and keeping people healthier longer. And the idea there is that by investing more money up front, you can keep medical costs lower for longer and hopefully save everybody money. Now, yesterday I sat down with Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa. He's on the Health Committee, and he's the author of a whole section of the bill that's under debate right now that focuses on prevention and wellness. Here's a quick excerpt of what Harkin says he's trying to do.
In the clinical settings, in communities, in workplace, in schools, to try to move us from a sick care society to a health care society. Right now, I keep saying, you know, we are a sick care society. If you get sick, you get care, but there's very little in there for prevention and keeping you healthy in the first place. And that's what I'm attempting to do.
All right. You'd think there wouldn't be much debate about prevention. And here's the one thing we know there's not debate about. We need to save money. This bill is estimated to cost something like, what, $1 trillion or more over 10 years?
Right. And cost savings is really what they need, especially after the sticker shock of this bill is sinking in Congress. And there are going to be other ways to raise money. But you're right, Catherine. There's a debate right now about how about prevention and cost savings and whether prevention really works. And not all prevention is the same. And while preventing disease is always the right thing to do because it's just the right thing to do, you don't get sick, it's not always the cost-effective thing to do, and that's a big debate right now. And the interesting thing is there's a debate on that in the scientific community,
really?
And in the economics community, but there's also a debate right in the health committee. It's like a microcosm of what's going on out there. We've been talking a little bit this week about the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. They're the mm-hmm. scorekeepers in Congress. They tell you whether a bill's going to cost money or save money, any bill. Well, the CBO won't give Harkin any cost savings on his prevention. And we all say, well, wait a second. Prevention
right.
saves money. What's wrong with the CBO? Well, CBO won't tell Harkin that his prevention saves anything. And it's not because prevention will save nothing. They don't know that. It's because the number crunchers have no way of accurately calculating it. So here's the committee dealing with prevention, but they don't get any benefit on that $1 trillion price tag. And it's a frustration for Harkin. Listen to this.
Okay.
One part of this bill now is our menu labeling bill, that from now on, all chain fast food places like McDonald's and all these other, if they have 20 or more restaurants, they have to post on their menu board and in their menus the calories for every single serving. And they have to have available, if you ask for it, in printed form, the amount of fat, trans fat, sodium, and sugar.
It's the right thing to do, but how do you score that to say it'll save money?
Well, that's the problem with CBO. They don't know how to score this. But they know it will save money because it's going to save people from going down and getting high blood pressure pills and having to do some kind of modality that costs more money later on.
So what are we supposed to do if we can't do that? We're supposed to just get everyone on drugs somehow?
Well, Harkin says no. He says exactly the opposite. Not get everyone on drugs. Do the things earlier than that. Lower salt, lower bad food, lower smoking, so that they don't have to get on the drugs in the first place. Listen to this.
Are we going to achieve it overnight? I'm realistic enough to know that we won't achieve it overnight. But I do believe in within a 10-year time frame, we can make a huge difference in this country in keeping people healthy and keeping them off of drugs, keeping them out of the hospital.
All right, Senator Tom Harkin. And Todd, thank you so much for this report. That's Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Well, now, moving on to another issue that Senator Harkin has been working on. It was unanimous. You might say it's a bit late, but the Senate unanimously passed a resolution yesterday apologizing for slavery. Here's more from Senator Tom Harkin. He first introduced the apology resolution years ago.
This Congress has never offered a formal apology for slavery and Jim Crow, and it's long past due. A national apology by the representative body of the people is a necessary collective response to a past collective injustice. So it is both appropriate and imperative that Congress fulfill its moral obligation and officially apologize for slavery and Jim Crow laws.
I remind you that it is 150 years since the end of the Civil War. We're going to go now to David Walrice, assistant professor of psychology at Morehouse College. He's also one of our contributors here at The Takeaway. Professor Rice, why is the Senate apologizing for slavery now?
Well, I guess, we did say good morning, first of all. I guess it is better late than never. I think that you look at the political and social climate. I think that as you see changes in and who are our representatives in the legislature, you see that there are a lot of things that, you know, were introduced years ago that you can finally have pushed through. So I think that, you know, we're in an interesting sociocultural milieu that allows individuals to get things done.
Now, who does this matter more for? I'm going to ask a question not quite what you're expecting. Does it matter more for African Americans or senators?
Well, that's an interesting question as well. I think it matters probably equally to both, even though I think senators perhaps would not necessarily be aware that it's necessary for them. I mean, what we're looking at, you know, I'm a psychologist who looks at narratives and discourse. So what's important is what's said and what's left unsaid. And when you're looking at a national horror that's committed against people, I mean, we owned slaves. You know, we owned black people. And so I think that certainly, you know, as a black person, we've suffered tremendous atrocities. I think Jim Crow being associated with that is necessary to be recognized also. But the perpetrators of those crimes are now allowed a little bit of psychological relief as well. And it allows us as a country to kind of move forward.
Reparations, most officially, were not part of this resolution.
Right.
And what does that say about the issue of both apology and reparation?
Well, I think it says very clearly that there's more work to be done. I think that, you know, one thing, when you look at the architects of kind of the individuals who are looking at reparations, Charles Ogletree and, of course, Randall Robinson, the first step is the fact that there needs to be an apology, there needs to be an acknowledgement. And so when there's that baseline, we can work from there. So reparations, I think it certainly is a dialogue that needs to continue, and it's a conversation that's going to be had. But I think that we need to acknowledge what has happened in the Senate. I mean, I think it's a big deal, Harkin and Brownback kind of talking about and introducing this legislation and acknowledging that it was a horror and an atrocity that was done to the people, and we need to apologize for it. That's big.
There are some – I'm looking at a Washington Post piece about the resolution passed yesterday, and there was at least one voice saying, look, this doesn't mean as much. We have an African-American president. We have more people in Congress now. What impact in either direction do you think the fact that we have the Obama administration in place, what does that say about the passing of this resolution?
Well, I think it says a lot. I think that certainly that's a large chunk of the sociocultural space that we're living in now. But I also think that it does mean a lot. I mean, I understand what people are saying. Time's passed, 150 years. We've got black people in the Senate, Congress. We've got a black president. All those things are great and are also noble attributes of the country. However, there are certain things that we had stepped beyond and stepped over, and I think that this apology is one of those things that becomes important. Again, in looking at a national dialogue, if somebody has not acknowledged a wrong that's been done to you, it's almost culpable to saying that it's okay, and it isn't. And so I think that it becomes important for us to kind of not just go past what has been done before, but to acknowledge what's been done past and to make sure that we're able to right it in multiple ways. We're talking about slavery and Jim Crow. It's not like we just own people and, oh, that's it. I mean, there's this psychological and cultural scar that's still left on a community and a people. And I'm not just talking about African-American people. I'm talking about people who are citizens of the United States.
Okay.
And so for us to acknowledge that becomes very important.
All right. David Walrice, I want to thank you for taking time out this morning.
Thank you.
David Walrice is an assistant professor of psychology at Morehouse College and one of our contributors here at The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway, from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
How I'd love, love, love to dance with my father again.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry today. It's the start of Father's Day weekend. Make room for Daddy. So come on, go ahead, tell us. What's the best memory you have of your father? Is there some moment that sums up what your dad means to you?
I'm Charlotte, and I'm age 6, and this is what I like to do with my dad. I like to go watch movies with him. I like to play with him and a lot of fun stuff.
Okay, now, I know you can't top a 6-year-old, but you can at least share your story with us. It's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks for that call, Charlotte. Did your mom make you do that? It's my take at thetakeaway.org. Going back into the news, much has been made recently of Twitter's influence in the protests in Iran over the elections. Time magazine called Twitter the medium of the moment. The U.S. State Department over the weekend, you might recall, asked Twitter to put off upgrading their network so in order not to disturb the tweets from Iranian protesters. But have we perhaps been making a bit too much about the role of Twitter? We're going to go now to Nicholas Thompson. He's the senior editor at Wired Magazine, and he has posted on his blog that we should be a little calm before we have a Twittergasm about all of this. Hey, Nicholas, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. Hey, I want you to listen to this quote from Robert Gates on the Internet and Twitter.
The freedom of communication and the nature of it is a huge strategic asset for the United States.
So between the media and the Department of Defense, are we overstating the role of Twitter here?
We are. Twitter is important. Twitter is interesting. But it's mostly a tool for helping us on the outside understand what's happening. And that's important because it focuses the world's attention on Iran, and that probably affects what the regime does. But it's not the tool that is being used to get all the people in the streets right now.
What is being used to get people on the streets?
Word of mouth, cell phones, text messages, Facebook to a larger extent than Twitter. The problem with Twitter is that Twitter is a totally open network. So if I post on Twitter, anybody can follow me. So there's no restrictions. So if you put if anybody goes up there and, say, post what's called the address or proxy server, which is a way for somebody to evade Internet censors, if you put that on Twitter, it will be seen immediately. So the best thing to do is to not put it on Twitter, to send it either in a private email or to send it over a text message or to call somebody with that information. And it's the same for getting somebody on the street. Now, Twitter is fantastic. Its openness is fantastic for us in the U.S. to follow it, right? I'm on a Twitter site right now by somebody named Persian Kiwi who's got these great, you know, moving posts about what's happening. So it gives all of us a connection to what's happening.
Hang on a minute, Nicholas. Yeah. How do we know that Persian Kiwi isn't writing these tweets in Burbank?
Oh, we have no idea. It could easily be in Burbank. In fact, it could be an Iranian Revolutionary Guard in Burbank. We have no idea.
So what does that tell us about perhaps the overstatement of the importance of Twitter?
I think that the problem with what we're saying about Twitter isn't that we're missing that there are fake accounts and that there's fraud and that there's probably deception. I think people kind of know that. I think what we're missing is we're overstating how many people in Iran are using it. We know that lots of people are sort of faking accounts and putting dishonest information up there.
Well, not to mention, how much of this is a class issue? I mean, you know, are we certain that, you know, every single person in Iran somehow has a cell phone or an online account?
Well, that's very interesting, right? So Iran has about 35% of people have computers or have Internet access. So that's, you know, it's the United States is obviously a much higher number, more like 85%. Of those people, they're mostly young people and they're mostly educated people who happen to be supporters of the reform candidates. So, yes, there's a real bias in lots of ways, one of which is that if you just look at the Internet, you would think that all of Iran supports overthrowing the regime, and that's certainly biased to some respect.
Let's just pause for a moment. Other news that came out today is that both Google and Facebook have launched Farsi language tools. I think they did them just last night. So what does that tell us about the events of the last week and their impact on the online community?
I think that's great, and I think Twitter should do it too. I think that I'm not trying to say that Twitter or other social networking tools have no role. They certainly have an important role. There's certainly something that U.S. Technological enthusiasts can work on, something that they can participate with the protests, something that can certainly help. But they're just not it's not the medium of the moment. It's not impossible to stop these things. They're not the centerpiece of what's going on.
Yeah, you know that one of the occupational hazards of being in the media is prolonged navel gazing. But you can't help but wonder, with the Twitter explosion, if part of it was because people all across the country were going, tweets, the Iranians, they're just like us.
Well, that's very much like it is. You know, we want to feel in a way that we're responsible for it, and that's partly why we're so excited about what's happening with Twitter.
All right. But if there was no Twitter, tell me if you think the protests would be just that large out there.
I don't think they'd be just that large. I think they would be slightly smaller. And I think the biggest effect, if there wasn't Twitter, was that we in the U.S. would have much less information about what's going on, and there'd be much less attention from the rest of the world. And that would have changed the way Ahmadinejad and the rest of the regime acts.
Now, we should also say that this isn't the only protest or political moment where online communication has been important. For instance, Georgia and Russia last summer, I think there was some of that. So to sum up here, what kind of turning point, not to overstate the impact of Twitter, but what kind of turning point do you think this week represents?
I think this is an evolution. I mean, we've seen it in lots of places. We've had, the Philippines and Thailand, where we've had regime change pushed by cell phones. We had major protests in the streets of Moldova 3 months ago,
right.
2 months ago, that were being directed in part by Twitter. I think we're seeing more and more of technologically led protests, and that's partly because the people who have technological tools are mostly young students, and they're often the people who lead social unrest.
Okay.
Now, there's one really important point here, and that is that we tend to think that all of this unrest and all this technological organizing is good. It's not necessarily good. It may well put in regimes we don't like. It just creates churn. In this particular case in Iran, this churn is something everybody in the U.S. does want.
Okay, Nicholas. I want to thank you for your time. Nicholas Thompson is a senior editor at Wired Magazine. And now joining us in the studio is Femi Okeh from our newsroom.
At 29 minutes past the hour, Texas billionaire Alan Stanford is scheduled to appear in federal court today on fraud charges. Stanford surrendered to the FBI last night. He's accused of running a multi-billion dollar pyramid scheme through a Caribbean bank. A federal judge wants to look at the notes from an FBI interview with the former Vice President Dick Cheney about who leaked the identity of a CIA officer. The Bush administration fought to keep the interview from becoming public, and the Obama administration has continued that push. Let's look at a couple of stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry today. Coming up in just a minute, we will be talking about all the voices pouring out of Iran, but we're also going to be talking with you about your dad and the stories coming in here to The Takeaway. Listen to this one.
My dad died when I was 21. I was an aspiring musician at the time, and my father never really understood my reasons for being a musician or understood why it was important to me. And about 2 weeks before he died, he came down to see me play with a band. This is the first time he had seen me in a long time. And he really enjoyed himself. And then about a week later, this is actually the day he died, we were riding around in the car and I was playing music for him and showing him what I really liked about these particular songs and why it was exciting. And he just looked at me, and I have to say, I think he got it. You know, we don't always get second chances in life, but at least I got a last chance.
Oh, every chance is so important. Thanks so much for sharing that. Tell us your story, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Back to the news. As we've been reporting all morning, tens of thousands gathered this morning in Iran at Tehran University to hear the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei speak. As protests continue, our partners at the BBC have been receiving interesting emails directly from Iran. Earlier this morning, in fact, we spoke with the BBC's Siavash Ardalan, a presenter with an international talk show program at the BBC's Persian television channel in London. The BBC Persian TV broadcasts into Iran from London. Now, when we spoke earlier, I asked Siavash to talk about what he's hearing today.
Ever since all these developments happened last week, ever since this election unrest, so to speak, occurred, the number of emails we've been receiving has gone up by 50-fold, 50 times. We've been receiving thousands and thousands of emails per day, which is remarkable given the fact that they've filtered most of the other websites, that all the lines of communication, virtual communication, have been blocked, and the internet connection is very slow. Nevertheless, people do send us emails, and most of it comes naturally from the protesters, people who are disillusioned with the election results, who believe that we're screaming foul play, and much of it reflects their frustrations and their hopes and their call on their comrades, so to speak, to carry on with the street protests that we've been seeing over the past few days.
So can you give us one or two direct?
Well, the Supreme Leader just gave a speech, which is a major turning point today. He basically and tacitly warned the protesters not to carry on their protests in the streets anymore. And if they do, they will face severe crackdown. That was the gist of what he said. And a minority of the emails that we've been receiving over the past 2 hours, which is when the speech finished, is some of them have expressed hopelessness. Oh, it's gone. The dream is gone. Now that he's said this, that's it, you know. The end of the protests. But the majority of the emails we've been getting has been calling on people to be steadfast and not to leave the scene. We've received an email from Tehran, from Mansour, who says, with this speech, Khamenei, which is the name of the Supreme Leader, he signed his own death warrant. And from now, he tied his own destiny to that of President Ahmadinejad. And now the people know exactly who the real enemy is. Another email comes from Isfahan, from Sarah, Isfahan, a province in south of Iran, and said that as we expected, and despite his own denials, the Supreme Leader took side with President Ahmadinejad, and this helped people exactly see who the real enemy is. And another email from Ali, doesn't say which city, he says that I hope that the opposition candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, I hope that he does not let up. I hope that he keeps his protest. There's a protest tomorrow scheduled by the supporters of Mir Hossein Mousavi, another silent demonstration in Tehran. And he's just saying that he hopes that protest will be carried on as scheduled.
What kind of change do you expect to see in the wake? I mean, just given that you've been getting this tenor in the last few hours, what kind of change do you think you're going to see in the emails coming in today?
I think people will be calling on Mir Hossein Mousavi, the opposition candidate, to be steadfast and to press on with the protests. They don't expect him to let up. There is this fear, because it has happened before, not to this extent, that many of the politicians who did express some kind of a dissent after a speech made by the Supreme Leader, they all kind of, you know, went back and then kind of crawled back to their own kind of places. So they're hoping that this time it will be different and that he doesn't let up. So that's pretty much the sentiment we're getting so far.
The Supreme Leader said that those protesting will be held responsible. I'm wondering if you're hearing any reaction of either fear or challenge from people writing in about what
most
that
of
actually
it, minority
meant.
Of it is fear. A small part of it is fear, but most of it is challenging. They're challenging the Supreme Leader. It's not us who is responsible. From now on, if anything happens, it's you who is responsible for any blood that might be shed.
And I think we should also be really clear that you are getting these emails in Farsi, in Persian.
Most of it is in Persian, yeah, mm-hmm. and some of it is in they transliterate it with a Latin alphabet, but still it's in Farsi. And also I do have to say, in all fairness,
yes.
These emails that we're receiving are mainly from those people who are disputing the elections, who are supporters of the opposition candidates. We're not getting too many emails from the supporters of the regime itself and the supporters of Ahmadinejad, who may feel either confident or may feel embarrassed by what's been happening from the aftermath of all these unrests.
And to conclude here very, very quickly, we've been talking about the fact that whether you were following the tweets or the Facebook entries, it's not necessarily always possible to know the provenance, if you will, of these online communications. So how certain are you that people are writing with their real names, that they're actually writing to you from their locations?
Well, you can never establish that. Mm-hmm. That's very difficult. But we have so much emails, it's just difficult to think there's one center sitting and organizing this mass misinformation. But nevertheless, many of them don't write their own names in particular, or many of them come with different Yahoo or Hotmail accounts. They email us. So it's very difficult to say in that way, but most of it does sound genuine.
All right. Siavash Ardalan, a presenter of an international talk show program at the BBC's Persian TV channel. BBC, of course, one of our partners. We're going to go now to Femi Okay with the latest from the newsroom.
Thank you. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is shoring up missile defense systems around Hawaii as a precaution against a possible missile attack by North Korea. Hawaii is the site of the main U.S. military base in the Pacific, and that base is around about 500 miles out of reach of North Korea's missile. Congress has sent the $100 billion war spending bill to the president's desk. The bill funds military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan through September. The Senate has unanimously passed a resolution yesterday apologizing for slavery, but the resolution explicitly says the apology can't be used to support reparations. And finally, what are you up to this weekend? Take a look at thetakeaway.org and search for Save Our Sounds. We are partnering up with the BBC to collect sounds that you don't hear anymore. And on the Save Our Sounds page, you'll find out how to take part, and we'll be playing your favourite sounds from the past on the air next week. Save Our Sounds at thetakeaway.org. That's your news for now.
Manual typewriters.
Oh, that's an old one. We got that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry is away today. We've been talking about Iran all week, and of course this morning, the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei delivered an address to thousands, tens of thousands, at Tehran University, saying that the elections were fair and that protesters would be held responsible for any chaos. So what's ahead? Less than 24 hours ago, Tony Karen, a senior editor at Time.com, had come up with different scenarios for resolutions to this crisis. So we thought it was a good idea to check in with him now to see what he thinks now. Hey, Tony, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, I'd like to get your reaction to this morning and what resolution you think things might be going to.
Well, I think one of the four options would have been Khamenei stepping back in some ways, using one of the mechanisms of recourse that had been available to the candidates, like the Guardian Council, to somehow say, you know, well, the vote wasn't clear or there needs to be a runoff. Or I don't think he was ever going to do a rerun of the election, but, you know, to somehow back down. Clearly, Khamenei is not backing down. He's thrown in his lot with Ahmadinejad. And that might be a critical error from his point of view in the long run, but it certainly rules out a victory, an easy victory for the protesters.
What were the risks facing this regime, and what are the paths left to them at this point, I'm wondering?
Well, I think the real problem for the regime and that we need to understand is this mm-hmm. is not a simple tyranny. I mean, this is a regime that in its school books, you know, teaches its children that a mass of people can overthrow a tyranny when they, you know, they feel they're being ruled in an unjust way. And it's always claimed its own legitimacy from two sources. The one is clerical religious authority of the, you know, the supreme leader and the various clerical councils that have oversight over the elected bodies, but also has a kind of managed democracy, but nonetheless a very lively one. elections to Parliament and to the presidency, in which the clerics determine who's allowed to run and set the limits, but nonetheless competitive elections, which is exactly, you know, what we're seeing now. The problem is when you tell people that their votes don't count and show them in a very graphic way that they're being overruled, it presents itself as a tyranny. It essentially destroys its own sources of legitimacy.
The protesters have been told that they will be punished for any chaos that they are responsible for. So what resolution do you see for them?
Well, it's a really difficult challenge for the leadership of this movement, because remember, Mousavi is not a reformist or a radical traditionally. He's very much part of the regime. He represents a conservative faction who are really alarmed by the direction that Ahmadinejad, with his provocations, was taking the country, both domestically and internationally. That faction stands to lose a lot if the regime collapses. And essentially, by telling them that they're more or less outside the law and that the full machinery of the state is going to be brought down on them, it creates a real dilemma. The Mousavi's group has basically been fighting on two fronts, on the streets on the one hand, but on the other hand, using their support, particularly via Hashemi Rafsanjani, in the clerical bodies, to try and put pressure on the Supreme Leader there. Right now it seems that, you know, the Supreme Leader is basically saying there's no room for compromise.
Oh, Tony Caron, I want to thank you so much for joining us. That's Tony Caron, a senior editor at Time.com.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. It's the start of Father's Day weekend, so let's start off with an ode to Dad. Go ahead, tell us, what's the best thing about your father? Is there a vivid memory or moment that sums up what your dad, or maybe it's your granddad, your grandpa, means to you?
Hi, this is Deborah Rubino from the Bronx, and my favorite story about my grandfather is not that I threw up all over him when I first came to the United States, but that the one time he was left at home with me and I needed to be changed, he took me out into the backyard and hosed me down instead.
Hey, it's efficient. I can see that. Go ahead, tell us your story. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Hey, Femi?
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is denying accusations that the country's presidential election was rigged. The Ayatollah says that the incumbent president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was the definitive victor and that you can't falsify 11 million votes. Back in the United States, the government is expected to release a long-delayed report out today on the CIA's secret detention and interrogation program. A heavily redacted version was released last year, and all but a few paragraphs were blacked out. The Supreme Court has ruled that prisoners do not have a constitutional right to DNA testing after their conviction. Chief Justice John G. Roberts wrote the opinion for the majority, saying that it's up to the states and Congress to decide who has a right to the tests. And finally, there are some new inductees to the U.S. Songwriters Hall of Fame this morning.
I can't sing a love song like the way it's meant to be. Well, I guess I'm
That's Bon Jovi, singing Always. John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora, two of the newest members of the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Bon Jovi?
Oh, it's just getting good. Sorry about that, having to fade that bit out. Seven new inductees were added to the Hall of Fame last night, including the songwriting team behind the musical Hair and Crosby, Stills and Nash. A little something for everybody.
Bon Jovi?
Hello, New Jersey. Have a great weekend, all. Catherine.
This Sunday is Father's Day. Please, please, tell us that you didn't buy a tie.
Joy to the world, a father's born. Let me receive great gifts.
Okay, if you're lucky, your dear old dad is not like Homer Simpson, but his bumbling cartoon portrayal of fatherhood is a time-honored one. It's just not exactly current. The way we look at fatherhood is changing, one stay-at-home dad at a time. We're going to go now to Jeremy Adam Smith, the author of Daddy Shift. He also writes the blog Daddy Dialectic. Hey, Jeremy, happy early Father's Day.
It's great to be here.
Now, you mix a lot of interesting history about the role of fathers in America, but you also interviewed your dad and your grandfather for this book. Talk about what your expectations were for those conversations and how, well, what happened?
Well, first of all, I dreaded having them. I don't come from the kind of family where we sit around talking about things like fatherhood or motherhood. And, you know, I really had to persuade them that this was a good idea to talk to me about this. And when I did, I discovered that we were all generationally straight out of central casting. For example, when I talked to my grandfather. Well, you know, I asked my grandfather, you know, what challenges did you face as a father? And he was a very working class guy, a World War II veteran, worked in a quarry for 40 years. And he told me that he didn't face any challenges. My grandmother did all that. She raised the kids. His job was to go to work every day and make enough money so that she would have enough and so that his kids would have enough.
I have to say, it's very 21st century language to use with a grandpa. What were your challenges?
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly true. Well, you know, and I had to explain that question
when
I asked it, you know, because he was like, what are you talking about? And he was a good father, by going to work every day, by making the money, by supporting his family. He sacrificed his health working in a quarry for that long. And by the standards of his time and his social class, he was a very good father. And then my father, when I spoke to him, you know, he was very much a baby boomer. You know, he wanted to be much more involved than his father had been. You know, his father had been a very remote and absent father. And, you know, and he wasn't. I would never describe my father as remote or absent. He was, you know, if he wasn't at work, he was around. And, you know, but and yet I think that he really struggled with the caregiving aspects of fatherhood. And I think that – and he certainly didn't share, you know, housework equally with my mother or anything like that. And that was a source of conflict in their marriage. They really didn't know how to, you know, renegotiate their roles, you know. But although he felt that something should be done differently. And for my wife and I, when I became a father, you know, we very much saw our roles as parents as something to be negotiated. You know, we assumed that we could both be breadwinners and caregivers. And in fact, as parenthood for us has gone on, we've switched roles over time. And, you know, one of the things I discovered as I started to research fatherhood in America for the book and travel around the country and interview parents all over the country is that that's very typical of many parents today.
And it's interesting what a change it is. I think that if you are a new father right now, you probably – it's hard for you to understand – how much work it took to get to a point where it's a small percentage, but dads can stay at home now in a way they couldn't even 10 years ago, really.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I mean, I think that people don't really appreciate, you know, there's still huge discrepancies between how much time women spend on childcare and housework and how much time men do. You know, that inequality has not been erased. And it's difficult for us to appreciate how much things have changed over the past 50 years, and a lot of the change for men. Women changed very rapidly over the course of the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s. Men changed much more slowly, but during the past 10 years, we've seen men change a lot in terms of their behavior. This, you know, Generation X, Generation Y, as they've become fathers, they've been much more involved than the baby boomers ever were. And, you know, this is not uniform. You know, I always talk when I go around the country, I talk to people about my book. You know, they always say, you know, my cousin's husband, you know, he's not like this, or my husband isn't like this. And that's, you know, that's perfectly true. You know, not everybody is down with the daddy shift. A lot of people are not. They resist it or they're uncomfortable with it. But lots of people are, including some people in unexpected places.
Like?
Well, for example, you know, I think we here in the Bay Area, I live in San Francisco, assume oftentimes, you know, with our smug, you know, espresso-sipping liberalism that, you know, involved fathers must be special to us. You know, because I saw lots of fathers out in the playgrounds when I was a stay-at-home dad.
Yeah.
But that's not true. You know, I traveled to Kansas City, and there are plenty of stay-at-home fathers there. And these people are liberal, they're conservative, they're religious, they're not religious. They come from all different economic classes and racial backgrounds.
Talk for a minute. You know, it's been talked about, I know, just within the culture, that we have a sort of sitcom impression of the bumbling dad. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, I think it's important to realize that all parents have a learning curve. You know, mothers have a learning curve. They become mothers and they struggle. I've seen plenty of women at this point in my life become mothers, and they have a learning curve. And dads have a learning curve, too. I think that for fathers, they experience it differently. And we as a culture are not accustomed to watching that happen. You know, for mothers, there's a script that they can fall into. And that script has negative aspects and it has positive aspects. For fathers, there really isn't a script. You know, they become parents and they, you know, there's a well-developed role to play in terms of being the breadwinner. And lots of dads play that role.
Okay. Jeremy, I'm so sorry. I have to stop this because you'll never believe it. I've got my dad on the line. I do.
Bring him on.
Hey, I will. Dad?
Yes.
Hey, it's your daughter. Happy Father's Day.
How are you doing, daughter?
I'm doing okay. Now, listen, what was your big learning curve on becoming a dad? And we've only got 20 seconds, okay?
Well, I guess just as your guest explained, it took a while. And I guess I learned it fairly well. Considering your outcome, I must have did all right.
You did great, Dad. You really did. Now, I'll talk to you later, but have a good Father's Day, okay?
Thank you for calling.
I love you. Bye.
Very good. Love you, too. Bye.
Oh, isn't it sweet when they choke up at his age or my age? That's my dad calling in from Moline, Illinois. And Jeremy Smith, author of Daddy Shift, How Stay-at-Home Dads, Breadwinning Moms, and Shared Parenting Are Transforming America. Thanks for being with us, Jeremy. Okay, I'm tearing up. Tell me your Father's Day story. Give us a moment that defines your dad.
My favorite memory of my father was one Christmas. We were not very well off, and we were told that we weren't going to have much of a Christmas that year. And my father was working. He was working late nights, you know, manual labor. And we all went to sleep that night, me and my younger brother, on Christmas Eve, not expecting much in the morning, and we were okay with that. We woke up that morning to find a very large number of presents under the tree, and what a wonderful Christmas that was.
Give us your favorite dad story. Go ahead, go to our website, thetakeaway.org. I want to wish every dad out there a great Father's Day weekend. I'm Catherine Lanfer, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.